This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Today on the show, we tackle healthcare from a variety of angles, from long-term care facilities in the state to deadly animal-borne diseases. But first, healthcare for our nation's veterans. Robert Wilkie is this country's Secretary of Veterans Affairs, and he joined me by phone. Secretary Wilkie, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, Ashley, thank you for having me.
You were confirmed to the role of secretary in July of 2018 after serving a few months as acting secretary. And I want to start with one of the Trump administration's and one of your top priorities within the VA system, and that is suicide prevention.
Because,
as I'm sure you are very well aware, veterans are almost twice as likely to die by suicide than the general population. In the recent past, we've had several prominent suicides happening on the grounds of VA hospital campuses, including the parking lots. How is your organization addressing veteran suicides?
Well, we've decided that the problems that we're experiencing in VA call for a national solution. And when I say a national solution, that's a solution that's outside of VA. And I will give you an example. One of my goals here, people talk about leaving legacies. Well, I'm not arrogant enough to say I'm going to leave a legacy, but having spent a great deal of my life in southern Oklahoma, on the other end of the Great Plains from you, one of the things that I want to make sure that VA does is address the particular needs of Native American peoples. And the suicide is one of those areas that I've been out with the nations asking for help. Because of the 20 veterans who commit suicide, 14 every day, 14 are outside of VA, which means we need help finding them. In Alaska, for instance, more than half of the veterans in Alaska do not have any contact with VA. I went up and asked the Alaska Federation of Natives to double the number of their tribal VA representatives to help us find them. But in terms of what we're doing at the national level, I am in charge of the President's Task Force on Suicide. So it is an effort that brings together the best medical and social science minds from DOD, HHS, NIH, as well as VA. And the second part of what I think the solution will be is to open the aperture to get funds and support out to the localities, to tribal organizations, to tie them into our systems to help find those. The other part of this that is particularly poignantly sad for me is my father was a very decorated combat soldier from Vietnam. Of the 20 who take their lives every day, the vast majority are from the Vietnam era, which means in many cases these are problems that began building when Lyndon Johnson was president. And I would be rather excessive if I told you that we were going to get this down to zero. I mean, that's an impossibility. But a one-off approach to it doesn't work. It requires the whole of government plus states and localities to get our arms around it.
One of the major problems facing veterans is the long wait times, and that has a significant impact when it comes to the suicide rates. How are you addressing the long wait times?
Let me take a step back, and I will refer to the Journal of the American Medical Association, not a publication that is known as a cheerleader for the federal government, but a publication that represents America's doctors. In January, they put out their study on wait times, both in the VA sector and the private sector.
And they are falling.
And they are good or better than any in the private sector. But for mental health issues, we have same-day appointments. If a veteran or a veteran's family comes to us and says there is a need, we have same-day service. The other thing that we're doing that has changed, and in going over my biography, there's one thing that I have in it that actually contributes to this, because prior to becoming the VA secretary, I was the Undersecretary of Defense for Personnel and Readiness. So I was responsible for not only the 2 million in the active and reserve force, but also for the training of those Americans who are transitioning into the private sector. And even for those warriors who have other than honorable discharges, VA is now open to them when it comes to mental health services. In the past, if you received an other than honorable discharge, you were not eligible for any VA care. It was a form of discipline that was put into the system back in the 1930s. But we've opened up our mental health care, particularly because of this issue.
Do you see unique challenges for some of our more recent veterans, as the advances in healthcare are able to, we're able to survive incredible injuries that a generation or two ago, that those veterans wouldn't be veterans. They would have died in service. And I'm wondering, does the physical care outpace the mental care when it comes to modern veterans?
That is as good or better a question than I have received in the now six or seven hearings that I've had before the Congress this year. You've hit on a two-pronged issue. Let me go at this one at a time. You are absolutely right. In my father's day, the types of injuries that you see Americans survive on the battlefield today, they would not have survived in Southeast Asia. They are living longer. But I also argue that we're not even at the Sputnik stage of mental health care. And in order to accommodate those younger veterans, we have to start preparing them when they're in service. And that means training, awareness building from the minute they go into boot camp. So they know the signs, they know what to look for in their buddies. But in terms of those life-altering injuries, it is my goal, and I've said this in testimony, that we at VA remain the world leader when it comes to spinal cord injury, when it comes to traumatic brain injury. And I'll give you an example. The last 10 years, there's been a great deal of talk in professional sports about the impact of football and ice hockey in professionals and collegians and the impact on the brain. Well, until I became the Secretary of VA, I didn't realize that all that famous research that people talk about that you see in the movies was being done by VA, in the Boston VA. When I met with my counterpart in Canada, I was happy to tell him that I have a closer relationship with the National Hockey League than he does, because VA, DOD, NHL, and the NFL are all working together when it comes to doing the research on traumatic brain injury. But VA is the leader. We're the leader there and in the spinal cord treatment, and that is absolutely essential to get our arms around the terrible changes that have occurred on the battlefield. Second part of that, where you're absolutely right, the younger generation, for the first time since the fall of Saigon, more than half of our veterans are under the age of 65. What does that mean? It means exactly what you said. They are computer savvy. They expect quick answers. They are not used to as they were in my father's generation, of sitting in a large room and waiting. And we have to adjust to them. So for a state like North Dakota, which has the majority of its veterans living outside of the city, that means being more creative. That means expanding telehealth That means getting our VA medical professionals into their homes wherever they are. It also means that with the Mission Act, we no longer force families in places like North Dakota to travel 300, 400, 450, 500 miles round trip to go to a VA facility if there is an opportunity to go somewhere else to get that treatment. Rural veterans make up 49% of our veterans population. I mentioned earlier, I'm particularly keen about Native populations and VA making sure it's doing enough for them. But the other component of that is rural veterans in general. One thing that people in North Dakota will appreciate is that here we are in 2019, and people in this town, Washington, D.C., still do not understand the scale of the American West. Having seen it as a child in Oklahoma, as I said, on that end of the Great Plains, it is amazing to me when I hear people debate health care, and they have absolutely no idea the unique challenges west of that great river and the challenges that you all have. So you are absolutely on target, and we have to adjust not only to meet the growing youth of our veterans population, but also the particular needs of rural veterans.
The dismissal of your predecessor, Dr. David Shulkin, and your appointment are seen as signs of increasing privatization of care. And this is a move opposed by many veterans groups, including the Vietnam Veterans of America. Is the VA moving towards privatization?
Well, let me give you the answer I gave in testimony. If VA is moving toward privatization, it is the craziest journey anyone could have ever taken. 10 years ago, our budget was $98 billion. The budget I presented to the Congress last month was $220 billion.
It's a record number.
Yes. In 2008, we had 280,000 employees. The budget I presented to the Congress last month called for 390,000. Privatization is a canard. And I also say that in conjunction with my interpretation of the Mission Act. The Mission Act is the most transformative piece of legislation to hit VA since the GI Bill. But let me tell you what it isn't first. It is not giving people like my father or even me, even though I'm still a reservist, but let's pretend that I'm on the retired rolls, giving me a card that says veteran and I can go out into the private sector and get any care that I want. All the Mission Act says is if the VA cannot provide a specific type of care that the individual needs, then we give the veteran the option of going into the private sector. Now, we've been doing something similar to that since the end of World War II. Since the end of World War II, about one-third of all of our veterans every year get some care in the private sector. In fact, we even pay for care outside of VA with the Bureau of Indian Affairs, the Indian Health Service. We pay for it at DOD to the tune of $1 billion worth of veterans care. What I have seen, though, as VA health care continues to improve, is that veterans are voting with their feet. And the percentage of veterans who are going outside of the system actually goes down. And the Annals of Internal Medicine in December said that VA health care is as good or better than any in any region of the country, and I believe that. And my goal is to make it extremely robust. But if we cannot provide the service that a veteran needs, then we have to give that veteran the option of going into the private sector.
Secretary Wilkie, we have just 30 seconds left here. There's been a lot of turnover in this administration's cabinet.
Yes.
Are you worried about your job?
No, I'm not. You know, this is the best kind of thing for me, and I'll tell you why. I was very happy at defense. I had responsibility for almost half of the budget. Tell you about the size difference. I have a workforce that can go up to 390,000 here. At defense, I had just a civilian workforce that I was responsible for of 700,000. And when this came, it came, thankfully, as the result of people like Jim Mattis and John Kelly recommending to the president that I was somebody who could do the job. So it came unexpectedly. That's the best kind of thing to do, to have. And I'll tell you why. I come from a military family. General Mattis used to say I was born in khaki diapers. I take that as an honor. So I could not have a higher calling than to be in this seat. And, you know, it is, it's a wonderful thing every day to walk in here and to be able to serve. So all those other things that all of us watch 24 hours a day, I'm not being trite when I say if I worried about all that, I couldn't do the job.
Secretary Wilkley, we are out of time. I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you, and I look forward to seeing you all. I hope I'll be up there sometime in the summer.
Coming up next on Main Street, artists and supporters are recognized for their work.
Next time on The Pulse.
Can I feed her? Is
of
that
course.
Okay? Okay. That's what you want.
Becoming a mother changes women's lives. It impacts their bodies and their health.
I remember being very tired all the time.
I had knee problems after I had him, feet problems.
We'll explore motherhood and women's health on The Pulse.
Tomorrow at 8 Central, here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg in studio with Director of Radio Bill Thomas. He is oftentimes our arts reporter because he takes a strong interest in the arts. And back in March, there was the Governor's Awards for the Arts. This is an event that happens every couple of years in cooperation between the North Dakota Council for the Arts and the Governor's
Office. That's right.
Office.
And because they happen during the legislative session, often actually the governor doesn't attend, but the governor did attend this time. So it's a very nice ceremony. I thought it would be fun to hear they opened it with a performance by a middle school group of drummers from Standing Rock. And let's hear a little of that. And they helped open up the event, and then several people spoke about their feelings about the arts in North Dakota, and people were honored. And at another time, we'll talk about some of the people who won the awards and honor them. But I thought it would be interesting to hear some of the things that Governor Burgum had to say about himself and North Dakota and the arts. And he starts off talking about the state's experience and his own experience.
North Dakota is certainly a state that is where it is today because of a rich heritage and the diversity of our people, and that diversity can be expressed and has been expressed through the visual and the performing and the folk and the literary arts that can capture our culture and our traditions and help us understand where we've been and who we are and where we're going. And now more than ever, I think we're kind of a crossroads of human understanding where humans have the potential to almost do anything and be anything, but what direction are we going to go with our planet? And the arts are essential to that understanding. We're fortunate that the first peoples that populated this geography, the Native Americans and the tribal communities that lived in our state, regarded all kinds of art, whether it was beadwork or painting, music, dance, were an integral part of their lives. And so fitting that we started tonight's program with the junior high drum circle from Standing Rock to put us in a place of respectful prayer and understanding that arts can touch the spiritual side of our lives as well. And certainly, I'm also grateful for my own parents. I think many of you, some of you may have known my mother, Catherine Kilborn Burgum, and her. She passed away at age 90 in 2005. But during her lifetime in North Dakota, she was a huge supporter of the arts, and feel very fortunate that our life growing up was simple in Arthur, North Dakota. But certainly, the arts were a big part of it.
So he talks about his personal connection there, but he goes on to talk about one of the things, if you follow state government, a big initiative of the Burgum administration is what they call their Main Street Initiative, and he talks about that in the arts.
And one of the three pillars is building vibrant, healthy communities, and integral to building a vibrant, healthy community is the arts. And if you want to think about, you know, the economic tie-in, if that's important to some people, maybe not this crowd tonight, but certainly we know that today when we're in a spot where we've never been in our country, where there's more jobs available in America than there are people seeking jobs, how we build and design our communities and how we integrate art into our schools and our institutions certainly influences where people want to live and the places they want to work and where they want to raise their children.
And the governor, of course, talks a lot about reinventing things and new design, and he brings art into that and our whole infrastructure.
Because everything we do can be done with art, and I think how we design cities really represents an opportunity for more incorporation of art.
And then finally, he talked about the mission statement that his administration has worked up for North Dakota, and he thinks that the arts really fits that mission statement.
Empower people, improve lives, and inspire success. And when I think about art and artists, when I think about what they do with their work, the risks that they take, the sacrifices they make, they are empowering people. They're improving lives and they're inspiring success. And so I think that there's a great match between what we seek and what every artist is trying to do, whether it's a performance on a stage or a song that's written or a poem delivered. It's really important.
So the governor of North Dakota, Governor Doug Burgum, thinks the arts are important and important enough for him to come out and really spend a big part of his evening at the Governor's Award for the Arts.
So who is up for some of these awards? Is it artists, art educators, supporters, activists?
It's not just you'd think, oh, it's like individual artists being honored for their accomplishment. And that does happen, of course. But also arts educators are a big part of it. And so almost every year there's somebody honored for their work in arts education. Also organizations that support the arts, like arts centers or even commercial companies that help support the arts. So all of these kind of things are up for honors at the Governor's Award for the Arts.
And you said he was well-spoken and passionate about supporting the arts. Is that reflected in the budget?
Well, he did say at one point, we didn't hear it in the excerpts that we heard, but he said, many people think the government should support the arts more, and perhaps it should. So that was something to say, but I think it's a whole even level in the budget.
All right. Bill Thomas is our director of radio, and we will have more clips from the Governor's Awards for the Arts. Thank you, Bill. Still to come on Main Street, a look at long-term health care in the state. But now it's time for the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. River ice along the Red River is creating issues for residents in eastern Walsh County. Emergency manager Brent Nelson says the ice is causing the Red River to back up, and he says the river topped several ag dikes on Tuesday and is now spreading west.
It's basically out towards the interstate. It's past the interstate in some areas. It's filling several sections of land, and it's caused primarily most of those roads between the interstate and the Red River to be closed. The North Dakota-Minnesota DOT is closed. Highway 17 between the states, that bridge is closed since there's water on the road in those areas. And there's several county and township roads closed in that area due to water across those roads as well.
Nelson says while Interstate 29 has not been topped by water, ditches along the highway are full.
So, and then it backs up the Forest River, which is entering the Red close to that area, is backing up. So that's causing flooding on the other side of I-29.
Officials with have a forecast of 38 feet on the red at Oslo for later this week. And Nelson says if it reaches that level, the flood of 2019 will be in the top five floods of all time for that county. Despite a few closed roads, ramps, and greenway trails, the flood fight for Grand Forks and East Grand Forks is moving along as planned. City leaders continue to monitor river levels as the crest should arrive Friday or Saturday at 48 feet. Both the Sorley Bridge and Point Bridge remain closed, leaving the Kennedy as the only river crossing between the two cities. Grand Forks City Engineer Al Grasser says access roads to homes in the Shady Ridge area of southeastern Grand Forks are getting wet, and the fire department has positioned equipment and emergency supplies in the neighborhood as a precaution. Grasser says most city pumps have also been activated to help with stormwater runoff.
Pipes are low, so the Red River's backing up into those pipes. So what happens then when we activate the pump stations is we close the gates, so we separate the system from the Red River. And then once that happens, we turn the pumps on so that any kind of interior drainage from snow melt and rain and things like that gets pumped back over to the river.
Unofficially, the Red River crested in Fargo this week at 35.03 feet. That is the 10th highest crest on record. And the hot tub at the Days Inn in Castleton is now open for public use after three positive cases of Legionnaire's disease back in February. An investigation determined all three had stayed at the Days Inn in Castleton. Michelle Detloff is program manager at the Division of Disease Control for the North Dakota Department of Health. She says the hot tub was closed while it was drained and sanitized, and several tests have proven it to be free of the bacteria that causes Legionnaire's disease.
That bacteria hasn't been found in there after some negative testing. So with consultation with Fargo CAS, Public Health, and then also working with the hotel water park, that spa is now open, but there is going to be continued testing for the next several months.
Detloff says Legionnaire's disease is a bacterial infection that can cause pneumonia. She says it is not spread from person to person, but can be transmitted by water sources that have specific conditions to grow that bacteria. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. This week on the show, we've been airing a series of reports on a lab that is to be used to study animal diseases, specifically deadly ones. The community of Manhattan, Kansas, is watching the massive National Bio and Agro Defense Facility go up at the north end of the Kansas State University campus. In the final report for Harvest Public Media, Laura Ziegler finds that some in the community are worried that healthcare, law enforcement, and emergency response teams are not as prepared as they should be, given the nature of the diseases.
Manhattan's main hospital, Ascension Via Christi, has 12 isolation rooms to put patients exposed to infectious diseases in. Carolyn Kane, Regional Director of Safety and Emergency Response for the hospital, badges in from the hallway with an electronic key hanging from her neck.
Anybody with a contaminant that is airborne. Right now, our primary use would be if we had a patient come in who was TB positive.
But at the National Bio and Agri Defense Facility, or NBAF, researchers will be dealing with pathogens a lot more exotic and lethal than tuberculosis. Take Nipah virus, which is transmitted through infected bats or pigs, or by contact with an infected person. Studying it requires a lab with the highest level of security, which NBAF will have. Experts pretty much agree that the chance of any disease escaping is remote, but they also agree there's no such thing as a risk-free lab.
We're standing in front of our decon area. Decon is short for decontamination.
We enter a sterile, white-tiled room where patients would strip off their clothes when they come in and shower before entering an interior examining room. The hospital has an infectious disease doctor who comes just once a week. Kane says this won't be a problem once NBAF goes online.
I have a lot of confidence in our emergency operations plan. If we're able to respond well to an infectious disease outbreak, we would be able to respond very well to something happening in NBAF.
In 2014, partly in preparation for NBAF, former Governor Sam Brownback moved the Kansas Department of Agriculture from Topeka here to Manhattan. Today, the wheat-colored building rests on a hill overlooking the sprawling NBAF site. For almost two decades, the State Agriculture Department, law enforcement, and the livestock industry have simulated coordinated response exercises across the state to an outbreak of foot and mouth disease. Justin Smith, chief veterinarian with the Kansas Department of Agriculture, says most producers have signed on to participate.
We utilize their operations. We talk to their cowboys. We talk to their feed truck drivers. And we work through this process on their operation.
This is all good, says Dr. Ali Khan, dean of the College of Public Health at the University of Nebraska. For several years, Khan also oversaw the biosafety program at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and has written extensively on what preparedness should look like. He says it involves a deep understanding and total transparency of what's going on in the lab.
Have you made sure that the individuals in the community understand what the risks are, what the pathogens are, and what they should worry about if they get sick? Had a good set of conversations with physicians, and if they haven't, then that's not a good practice.
Before construction on the lab began, there was a small but vocal opposition of researchers, citizens, and some ranchers. Over the years, their voices have died down. Bill Dorsett, a biologist, and Sylvia Beeman, an entomologist, were among them. We met outside the construction site.
I've never been this close.
The scale is much bigger than I could ever have imagined.
Yeah, you don't see it from outside. From down at the gate, you don't see this.
The two of them are resigned to living in NBEF's shadow. Dorsett believes they never had a chance of stopping it.
We were pebbles in the path. We weren't speed bumps.
Rancher Don Teske knows how NBAF's work could benefit his cattle herd, but the 63-year-old farmer also insists studying foot and mouth disease in a state where cattle outnumber people 2-1 is a head-scratcher.
I knew that would be dealt with utmost care, but that still doesn't mean I'm convinced that there won't be any escapes. I hope it doesn't happen, but I suspect it will.
As the cattle huddle against the bitter February wind, craning for sorghum he's tossed on the ground, Teske admits the lab is doing something good for his family, at least for now. His 27-year-old son is helping build it. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Laura Ziegler.
Harvest Public Media is a reporting collaboration focusing on America's rural and ag issues. Up next, the cost and quality of long-term care in North Dakota.
How did ancient Polynesians settle on so many islands that are separated by thousands of miles of ocean?
There was this question, who were these people? Where had they come from? And, of course, you know, how did they get there?
Ponder the puzzle of Polynesia. Visit a national park.
You can hire guides to take you out backpacking in many parks.
And get help planning a trip to France on the next Travel with Rick Steves.
Tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Providing consistent, effective, long-term health care is no easy feat. My next guests work as a bridge between families, lawmakers, and health care providers. Shelley Peterson and Craig Christensen are with the North Dakota Long-Term Care Association. Peterson is the president and Christensen is the chairman of the board. And they joined me from our Bismarck studio. Shelley, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Ashley. Pleased to be here.
Craig, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
The North Dakota Long-Term Care Association. Shelley, what is the work that you do?
The Long-Term Care Association is a statewide professional organization, and we represent three types of facilities, skilled nursing facilities, assisted living facilities, and basic care facilities. So every day, these types of facilities provide 24-hour care and services to residents throughout North Dakota. And our two main activities that we do are education, training, information, communication on, you know, the latest standards of practice, the most current federal regulations, state regulations. So information and education, so providers really know what the requirements are. And then our second focus is lobbying during the legislative session. The state legislature determines all the funding for nursing facilities, and it's key and critical to being able to provide good resident care, having sufficient funding. So that's the second major focus is lobbying and trying to lobby for money for residents.
And do you have sufficient funding?
Not yet. We're hoping when the session ends.
Help.
Yeah, we need help. We're hoping when the session ends in a couple of weeks, we'll be in a better position.
Well, give us a sense of where you are at and where you would like to be.
Well, probably our main initiative during the session was to get proper inflationary adjustments. What happened in the last legislative session, as you know, North Dakota's economy had a downturn. And as a result of that, no one got inflationary adjustments in their rates. And so nursing facilities did not get any annual inflator, which meant all the staff. And we calculate about 15,000 staff in basic care, assisted living, and nursing facilities are working in long-term care. We didn't have any inflationary adjustments, even though health insurance increased dramatically. We have brand new federal regulations. We're in a 3-year implementation. And so this session we went in with what we thought was a very reasonable request to have a 3% annual inflator. And that's for all operations to cover every cost and then to give raises for staff coming off a 3-year period of not having inflationary adjustments. So we thought it was very reasonable. Right now, the Senate is at a 2% the first year of the biennium and a 3% the second year of the biennium, and the House is at a 2 and a 2.5. Our request is a 3 and 3. You know, if we could pass that all on to our employees to give them a raise, still that 2% is a little over $2 a day. I mean, $2 a day, that's not enough money. Right now, we have 80% of the facilities using contract agency because we don't have sufficient staff. We've got to stabilize our staffing, and that means we need at least that 3 and 3 inflator so we can have a reasonable salary package that rewards people for caregiving. Mm-hmm. And we're not quite there yet.
The cost of staying in these facilities, though, in some instances in North Dakota, we're talking about upwards of $10,000 a month to live in a facility. Craig, let's talk about the cost of health care. Why does it cost this much?
I've been in Valley City for the last 29 years as the administrator, and I've seen the cost of the long-term care piece of it continually move upwards. But the main reason our cost is that the labor force that we need, and we are a labor-driven industry where you can't have robots to do the services that we do. We need the compassion. We need the love, the caring people that are willing to come in every day and help individuals through their daily activities, help them maintain a respectful and dignified life. The staffing really is the main mechanism that's driving our costs. 80% of our cost in most nursing facilities are made up in salaries and benefits. So when you take 80% out of your operational budget and look at that, that doesn't leave a whole lot for the building, the foods, the meals, the housekeeping, the heat and electricity that all, you know, also has to be contributed to that. So it really is a labor-intense industry, and we need to basically support our staff and get the right people to work there, because not everybody can do this work. And it does take a very special individual that is caring and loving and will dedicate their day helping them make it through their day in a respectful manner.
Well, and it can oftentimes be difficult on their health, too. It's very difficult to be a healthcare provider from both a physical and mental standpoint.
Yes, it is, Ashley. And to be honest with you, after 29 years of being involved in this business, it's a lot of time on your feet. You're having to adjust to different issues, you know, in a matter of seconds, because individuals' personalities are different mm-hmm. in every place. So mm-hmm. it does take a unique individual.
But going back to that upwards of $10,000 a month rate, part of why we're having this conversation today is in response to an interview that we had back in early March, and there was a listener who had some frustration with our guest's inability to answer some questions about the costs, and he wrote to us about the equalization of rates, and that's something that is somewhat unique to this area. So what does that mean, equalization of rates, and how does that impact the cost of health care, long-term care specifically?
Ashley, equalization of rates, what that does is basically provides the same level of cost to an individual for the level of service that is needed. In long-term care, our reimbursement system has 44 different levels of cost. And when a person comes in, they are initially assessed and determine what level will they fall in between 1 and 44. And that would be their cost for that period of time, unless there's a significant change or a hospital stay. Then there would be another assessment done. But what that does is basically whether you're medical assistant or whether you're a private pay person, they're paying the same amount for that same level of care.
So Medicaid controls the cost. They determine the rate based on our cost reports. And only in North Dakota and Minnesota do we have, quote, that equalized rates where Medicaid determines the rate of the private pay and the Medicaid. And I know there was a comparison of South Dakota. Why is South Dakota so low? South mm-hmm. Dakota and Texas are the two states in the nation with the lowest, poorest rates in the country, their Medicaid rate. But what happens in those states and all the other states except Minnesota and North Dakota is the private pay much, much more. As an example, in South Dakota, their average rate for the private pay person is an additional besides what the Medicaid rate is established at. Then if you're private pay, you have an extra rate from $75 to $100 extra per day because their Medicaid rate is so low. We can't cost shift like that. If you come in, it doesn't make any difference if you're a Medicaid recipient or private pay. The rate you will be based on the assessment, and it's against the law to charge them more. So in having that equalized rate, it's fair to the consumer in what they're paying. You know, the vast majority of facilities in North Dakota, another thing that's unique is they're nonprofit, community, many church affiliated. We only have 3 for-profit nursing facilities in the state, as opposed to the rest of the country. It's the vast majority are for-profit, corporation or individual owned. So we're not looking at trying to make a profit. We're trying to at least stay in the black. But right now, 2/3 of the nursing facilities are losing money, hundreds of thousands of dollars, because of not having that inflator restored for 3 years and now going into another session worried that we're not going to get enough money to pay staff.
Is that 2/3 spread somewhat evenly across the state, or are there areas that are disproportionately affected?
Yep. When we look at who is operating at a deficit, it's urban facilities, it's rural facilities, it's small facilities, it's large facilities. There's not a unique characteristic on why are they operating at a deficit. There simply is not sufficient money in the system to operate the way that at the standard that we want to. Now, the other thing that's unique about North Dakota is we're number one in the country. CMS ranks states on a 5-star system, 5 being the highest, the best that you can attain. And North Dakota is number one in the nation in our staffing because we take pride in making sure that we have sufficient staff to make sure that people don't have to wait, so that when you have to go to the bathroom, that nurse assistant is there to help you then, so that when you need the nurse is there. So we take great pride in having sufficient staffing because there's been studies that determine the quality of care and the outcomes residents receive is based on the number of staff you have. If you don't have staff, it's hard to deliver care. Mm-hmm. And so North Dakota ranks high, but that costs money to make sure that we have one caregiver maybe to 8 residents, whereas in other states it's 1 to 12.
Well, Shelley, when you talk about staffing issues and challenges of finding staffing, in some professions, particularly ones that have real high educational burdens associated with that, the cost of the schooling needed to act in this profession, and then they oftentimes can work out something with a state or sometimes on a federal level for loan forgiveness. And you mentioned Yep. early in the interview lobbying for things like 3% raises year over year. Do you ever lobby for things like loan forgiveness, debt forgiveness, if you stay to work in the state for 5-10 years? I'm not sure what a reasonable
yep,
number is.
That is a great question, and absolutely we have. And we're really proud of that. The legislature really did step up a number of years ago. And every facility has an opportunity either through a loan repayment or a scholarship to give $15,000 per person to anyone that would become a nurse, so an LPN, an RN, and other professions that are in high need, like a dietitian. We're having a hard time with dietitians. Mm-hmm. So the facility can seek out individuals in high school. Hey, do you want to go to school? I'll give you a scholarship when you come back and work for us. $15,000 of your student loan will be paid off. Now, the commitment we expect from them is that they would work for us for 4 years. And we think once they work for us, they'll love long-term care in their stay.
Do we need to think differently about who qualifies as a caregiver and how they're compensated? Are there parts of this that could be kept potentially lower cost if more of the care is provided at home by a relative?
Ashley, we have looked into this in many different ways. We've talked about, you know, combining services between housekeeping, CNAs. We've talked about different ways that we can consolidate the responsibilities in ways that we can be more efficient in how we manage the cost of labor. But as of right now, because of basically restrictions legislatively or regulatory-wise, you know, we still look at caregivers as having to be that individual that has to have 75 hours of training prior to them even taking care of anybody. Now, again, that's a little different than most other industries, but it does slow down the whole recruitment retention process simply because we need to do the training for those individuals up front before they actually step in and help.
The other thing, Ashley, that we are very supportive of, you talked about, could we do a better job of in-home care to help keep people independent? We absolutely support that. We want people to stay at home for as long as possible. And then we want to be able, when they come into our facility, rehab and go home if that is an option. Right now, about 50% are rehabbing and going home. But when we look at the cost, you know, the reason that in-home care can be very affordable is because it is intermittent care. Mm. It's not 24-hour care like we're delivering. So, yes, we need to support the family. We need to support those caregivers. We need to provide in-home care. But they're struggling with the same workforce issues that we are. As an example, too, when you look at our cost, the average cost in a nursing home in 2018 was $271 a day. So that's about $11.30 an hour. So $11.30 an hour for an average cost in a nursing home. When we look at in-home care, the average cost for the intermittent care of trying to get caregivers in was $25 an hour, $25 to $30 depending on the agency. But $25 an hour for in-home care works because maybe I only need a couple hours a day. But when they need 24-hour care, and we look at why people are coming into facilities, is because there comes a point when the family just can't do it and they reach out and they need help. And it's very different for every single family. But we have the highest proportion of private pay people in facilities right now because it is quality of care, quality of life, and cost effective to deliver it when you need that 24-hour round-the-clock nursing care. When we look at even if we needed an RN to set up my mom's medication, 1 hour of an RN ranged in the agencies from $65 to $85 an hour just for an RN. And then if you got a Medicare certified agency, it was $175 to $250 per visit. So on an intermittent basis, in-home care works awesome. But for one out of two North Dakotans, they're going to need a little bit of long-term care. So everybody should be thinking about it. When something happens, if I have a stroke, if I have a heart attack, what am I going to do? Can my family help me? Can my spouse help me? How about contracting for staff in the neighborhood? Or do I turn to an agency? And there are people around to help decide and help support families. But then nursing facilities, right now on any given day, we have about 5,600 people in a nursing facility. I don't know what we would do without them. And when I look at my mom and the care that she's now getting in a specialized unit, her mental health, her physical health has improved. It is really a much better environment for her and for my sister, who was a primary caregiver, because we could see the stress on her. It was taking its toll. It really, really was. And we see my mom coming to life a little bit, being more around people. So for us, it was another decision that we thought was in the best option for my mom.
Well, we are out of time. Shelley Peterson and Craig Christensen with the North Dakota Long-Term Care Association, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Ashley.
Dakota Datebook is next.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
This is Dakota Datebook for April 10th. On this date in 1908, the State Line Herald of North Lemon in Adams County announced that a car breaker had been arrested. A railroad brakeman noticed that a man seemed to be trying to break into a parked car. The brakeman immediately called for Sheriff Joe Hunt, then went back to keep an eye on the thief. When Hunt arrived, he found a man named Frank McCarthy inside the car, helping himself to the groceries he found there. The following morning, Judge Wakefield held a preliminary hearing, and McCarthy was bound over for trial. The newspaper noted that car theft in the area was on the rise. The paper connected this increase in crime to the railroad. Whenever the railroad arrived, there was a spike in car theft and other minor crimes. It was a common situation across the state. At one time, citizens of small towns knew all their neighbors. But with the arrival of the railroad, strangers drifted in and out. Those committing the crimes were often gone by the time the offense was discovered. Car theft was a particular problem for law enforcement, especially near a state line. The thief could quickly be gone, off to another state, where North Dakota police officers or county sheriffs had no jurisdiction. That changed in 1919 when the Dyer Act was passed. Popularly known as the Motor Vehicle Theft Act, it made it a federal crime to transport a stolen vehicle across state lines. That brought the FBI into play. And the penalty was stiff, up to 10 years in prison. As you might imagine, the theft of cars began just as soon as they hit the road. The first recorded car theft occurred in Paris, France, in 1896, when Baron Van Zuylen's Peugeot was stolen by his mechanic. Today, car theft is on the decline. Auto insurance companies attribute this to cars that are harder to start without a key, harder to break into, and equipped with anti-theft devices. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Carol Butcher. I'm Meryl Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
On the next morning edition, is President Trump defending himself on Twitter or just picking fights?
Until the civility starts on the other side, I don't see any reason why the president should tone it down.
Also, can a farmer in Kansas defeat an indestructible opponent?
It's just an absolute fascinating plan.
Hear the news and stories you will talk about all day long on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
That's it for this Wednesday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show, understanding impacts behavior. There's a growing awareness of what is and is not appropriate behavior between men and women. And we're joined by psychologist and author Frieda Birnbaum. Also coming up tomorrow, Sue Balcom joins us for Main Street Eats as she shares some foodie thoughts for Easter. That's coming up tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.